You're trusting somebody to take over your mortgage, and you're convincing somebody to be the bank, whether they are the person seller financing or letting you take over a property sub to, or if you are a private money lender. You want to be the bank, but you don't have processes that the bank has, and you don't have all of these additional rabbit holes that you should go down. So I tell people you want to be the bank, but banks have processes. The question is, do you?
Welcome to today's episode of Nursing Real Wealth. Our guest, Melissa Palmer, is a military veteran with a fascinating journey in real estate. She's not only a buy and hold investor, but also actively involved in developing a commercial dirt lot. What sets her apart is her unique background as a former federal agent, and she's here to share how she's leveraging her skills to provide investigative due diligence services for investors using private money. Get ready to dive into her incredible story and gain valuable insights into the world of real estate investing. Melissa, thank you for joining. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Well, let's dive in right away into how did your journey as a buy and hold investor begin? What kind of lessons did you learn along the way from that?
Sure. Yeah. So I bought my first property in 2009 in Vegas. So bottom of the market. In fact, it might have been 2008. Bottom of the market, good time to buy. But at the time, my mindset was completely different. Obviously, all of us have, you know, growth and different versions and chapters. But at the time, I was totally Dave Ramsey mindset. Bottom of the market, homes were going for $70,000 in Vegas, or at least they were listed for $70,000, and then they were selling for, you know, $60,000 over asking. And so it's funny because no matter the time and the characteristics of the market, the through line is, whether it's the 80s, the 90s, 2007, today, real estate is crazy. It's like kind of the through line that you hear. So That's when I bought my first property. I was very young. I had a VA loan. So that's how I purchased it. And I didn't want anything to do with holding it. I wanted to get out of there. I was terrified because everybody was losing money. But it was actually cheaper to have a mortgage than it was to rent. So Dave Ramsey me wanted to save some money. And that's how I started. I actually started investing though in 2016. And that was while I lived in Hawaii, and used my real estate or my VA benefits there as well. So I found out really quickly. I got stationed in Monterey, California, and I saw the prices and I was like, this is absurd. I am not buying a house here. And went to Hawaii and realized it can get worse. So I realized, I was like, well, I'm either going to piss away my money in rent or I can buy. I'm going to be here for 3 years. I have a unique opportunity to get into a market that's incredibly difficult to get into, whether it's California or Hawaii, and using my VA benefits with zero down payment. What they don't tell you is all of the fees that are associated with the zero down payment. So you still have to come up with $30,000, $40,000 cash to close. But I bought a house specifically to renovate and live in part of it and then rent out the other part. It took 3 years and some mediation and arbitration with a developer, and lots and lots of contractors running off with down payments. And many lessons there. I found out quite a few ways to protect myself in that little journey and ended up with a beautiful asset that I rented out for 3 years before selling. So lessons were learned. And here we are today, still learning lessons and still investing. And I've got a couple of my primary market is Big Bear, California. I've got a short-term rental, a triplex, and then the dirt lot that I'm developing there.
Nice. Just a little bit of a divergence there. Tell us a little bit about the dirt lot. That's interesting. Some people may not have an idea. What is a dirt lot?
Yeah. So it's just a completely there's no hookups. There's no, the one thing it has is an address. And so often you'll see properties that are just vacant land and they won't even have an assigned address. And even that is a permit and a process. And so the one thing this lot has is a permitted address, but it doesn't have any hookups. Hookups are available in the street, and I'm in the pre-development phase working with my architect. I've got an architectural design firm that I'm working with, and the intent is to build, well, it's changed a couple times because I'm trying to work with what is permittable, like already permissible, so I'm not getting special use permits. But, you know, it's a commercial residential lot, which in theory sounds like you can do commercial or residential. But in practice, once you get deep into the code, there's minor use permits, there's permissible use, there's it's permissible if you have XYZ. And so it has transformed to what was supposed to be a coffee shop and tiny cabins to a office space, essentially, and then some Sprinter van hookups because there are annual van conferences that are held in Big Bear. And just in practice, you can have hookups that cost as much as an Airbnb without linens and cleaning and the rest that goes with it. So it's kind of a cool opportunity to
that is attractive.
Pain in the butt.
Yeah, so. That is very attractive. Cool. Maybe can you share some insights into your previous experience as a federal agent and how it's influenced your approach to real estate investing?
Sure. So I hit 16 years with the Air Force this July. I'm still a reservist. I did 12 years active duty from 2007 to 2019. And in that time, I became a special agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. So I went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center and I ran our federal cases for the Air Force. So typically they had an Air Force nexus. Sometimes there were other branches, just depending on our sister or brother agency availability. And so I did that in Japan, in Hawaii, and in Hong Kong as an export enforcement agent. So working with Homeland Security and Department of Commerce. So kind of diverse. We were really small agencies. So we did everything from criminal investigations to counterintelligence investigations and export enforcement. And coming back to my real estate experience, I started prior to Sub 2. I joined that mentorship in January 2022 to explore all of the creative financing options in real estate. And my previous experience in real estate was in the traditional mortgage world and a lot of DIY fix and flip type of stuff, or fix and hold rather. And as I got into creative, I really wanted to understand the process from beginning to end. And so I got into transaction coordination so that I could touch everybody's files and work on other people's transactions while also working on my own and getting all of that additional insight and experience. And so I found the transaction coordinator process to be very paperwork oriented, which is also the investigator process. But there was always so much more to it than what was in my actual scope of work that I just wanted to know more about. And as I got better at underwriting, as I got better at kind of just foreseeing some of the things that can go wrong, I realized there was so much more that could be done for due diligence, because in a traditional real estate transaction, you're kind of just looking at an appraisal and an inspection and calling that due diligence. Maybe you're talking to the county or the city if you want to do some land development, right? Or any adjustments to the use of the property. But due diligence is just this big undoven into topic when it comes to private money lending and creative finance. So you're trusting somebody to take over your mortgage, but and you're convincing somebody to be the bank, whether they are the person seller financing or letting you take over a property sub to, or if you are a private money lender. And so you want to be the bank, but you don't have processes that the bank has, and you don't have all of these additional rabbit holes that you should go down. So I tell people you want to be the bank, but banks have processes. The question is, do you? And that's where I started realizing there was an opportunity to use my investigative skills, because I used to have access to all these law enforcement databases. And once I started doing research, I realized I could get the same access from the commercial use side based on fraud prevention. And as somebody who conducted fraud investigations, and just somebody who conducted criminal investigations, my least favorite part about it was that the best case scenario is someone goes to jail. And it's like, that's already, you can't undo what's been done. And so I love that this is a preventative way to look at it. And so I'm trying to be proactive with this service and offering this service rather than reactive after bad things have already happened. So.
Yeah, that's excellent. Very, very attractive offering, you know, to anybody who's getting into private money lending, especially if they're newer, making sure that they're really covering their bases and protecting themselves. We're talking life savings here, you know, for right. A lot of people. We're investing. Private money lenders are investing, not typically, they may be investing other people's money, but a lot of private money lenders are investing their life savings. So this is extremely important.
Right.
So as someone who provides the investigative due diligence services for investors leveraging private money, what would you say are some of the really key due diligence practices you recommend everybody does for real estate investors?
Yeah, I just start with, it's controversial, with background and credit checks at the end. Like, you background and credit check somebody that sits in your rental property for $100 of cash flow a month. Somebody taking $50,000 to $100,000 of your money absolutely should be background and credit checked. So, sorry, no cash, no credit, no problem. It's kind of a problem when you're taking other people's money. So, and that's not to say if somebody's got bad credit that they can't borrow, but it's a question of why they have bad credit. And if that bad credit is because of their failure to pay bills, then that's a huge indicator that they're not going to pay your loan. So,
you know, you provide a service called a borrower's passport, which is not something everybody's going to be familiar with. But, you know, so it's a product that I believe we're going to probably see a lot more of in our private money lending communities. So what is a borrower's passport, and how does it add value to the investors that are involved?
Yeah, so I offer it as a way for borrowers to show people that they're to be trusted, not tell them that they're to be trusted. So it's a third-party verified report where I go through their background, background of fraud, liens, judgments, any criminal history, and credit, and then their background, education, and experience. And this is verified. So they can basically present themselves with a professional, I call it a passport because it's a stamp in time. It is at this time when I conducted this background assessment on them, this was the information that existed, right? And so that's why I call it a passport, and that could change, but that's what I'm currently offering it as. And it helps them because, again, it's third-party verified. So this is me saying I've actually looked at their background credit and their history, and it's verified, and they're claiming they've got this education and these professional licenses, and I pulled the records and it's true. Or I asked them to verify it with their license number and then checked with the Department of Insurance, or, you know, whatever rabbit hole you want to go down. But at least it's third-party verified, and you're not just trusting what someone says at face value.
It adds value to the borrower because it adds credibility to their package, basically. But it also adds a lot of value to a private money lender as well, because they're able to go and see what this person is versus trust their word.
Right.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So, the borrower could go and seek this out on their own. But let's say a private money lender wants to go and incorporate this into their structure. What are some different ways that a private money lender could put this into their structure and add it to their requirements for anybody borrowing money from them? Because it seems like this would be something every PML would want to make sure they're doing for every transaction.
Totally. Yeah. So, and I tell PMLs this is something that the borrower should pay for or that they should roll into the cost of the loan. And it just depends on how you want to structure that. If you want to pay that, and I tell people, either way, it's worth the money because if you want to pay $1,600 for a loan to not go through because you find out information, derogatory information that leads you to not lend on it, then you're welcome because now you just saved yourself the complete headache, loss of peace of mind, not to mention the actual loss of money associated with a bad loan. So one, if they're paying for it, I'd still say you're welcome. But two, the idea is that if you're capable of working with your borrowers on the front end where they're actually paying for it, then it's nothing to you. So either way, it's something that if somebody wants to borrow or lend rather professionally, that they should build into their model because it's not a matter of if things go wrong, it's a matter of when. So it's just being able to know that you have mitigated your risks to the best of your ability and that you have professionally conducted yourself as the bank. So for lenders, to answer your question specifically of how they can incorporate me, usually I tell people to say, hey, this is part of my process and we require this. So please talk with Mel Palmer and she will get you started with the borrower's verification. Now, the problem is, and what I'm doing with Logan and Eric is the borrower's verification is a longer process because it's a one-page website that, you know, it's hosted by me, so third-party hosted. At first, I was providing reports, but the thing is somebody can manufacture a report. So I want people to actually go to my website and password protected based on, you know, Justin says, yep, here you go. Here's my password. You can check out my borrower's passport. And so it's a longer process to actually do the passport if they're coming to me proactively as the borrower. Now, if the lender's coming to me and wants a verification, that borrower is not getting that full service because it takes longer and we want to make sure that I'm not holding up a loan getting funded or close of escrow or whatever. So it's shorter, but you're not going to get that passport anymore. That is now a requirement based on the lender's lending application, essentially. And so it's better if borrowers come to me first. And it is also, you know, something we'd like to establish as a community practice so that snakes in the grass can't get away with some of the shenanigans that they've been getting away with.
Absolutely. Yep. Cool. So that's something definitely worth pondering and figuring out how to structure that into my own practice there. So definitely food for thought there. Hopefully food for thought for many of our private money lenders, listen up. All right. And then I guess the last thing is in this section kind of about due diligence and whatnot, you work as a TC as well. And
no longer.
I think you and I both, no longer. Good for you. Okay. Well, we won't advertise that service, but you did work as a TC. So I'm sure you've seen this same practice that I'm going to bring up. I see a lot of new investors who almost seem to want to replace their real estate attorney with a transaction coordinator. Now, what specific roles and responsibilities does a transaction coordinator have in actually securing funds for the private money lender? And then where is that really what should be a distinctive line between the work of the TC and the involvement of the real estate lawyer in real estate transactions?
Yeah. Yikes. Big yikes. that's, you know, I use these analogies where it's like trying to hammer in a nail with a MacBook. Like, would you do it? Maybe don't. It's not the right tool for the right job. I mean, it's just, it's very bad practice. It's absolutely not equatable. I say TC is to title and escrow, as TC is to due diligence, as TC is to attorney. They are correlated and they are compatible in the process, but they are completely different roles and responsibilities. So people like to turn to TC to be their catch-all, end-all, be-all. But at the end of the day, their job is opening escrow, not even doing the contract for you, because you should have your own contract completed. Without a contract, there is no transaction, first of all. So you should have your own agreements prior to even engaging with a TC, unless they're on your payroll and you have a prearranged process with them. So first, outside of a TC, contract must exist, whether it's a JV agreement, that promissory note, or your purchase contract. Then opening escrow to close of escrow and all the communication in between is where a TC's role lies. So they're often used far more than that small scope of work that I've explained to you, and they are often extremely knowledgeable and capable of doing more than that, but that is not their job and they cannot replace an attorney. So that's what I'll say about that.
Absolutely. All right. What are your long-term goals as a real estate investor, and how do you plan to achieve those goals?
Great question. So if you asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said something that's very typical, like 10 doors and $10,000 of cash flow a month and blah, 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 blah. Honestly, when it comes to real estate, I don't want anything to do with it except for to reduce my taxable income. I want to build businesses like this due diligence service. I want to build community like my coffee shop and the RV. I want to use real estate, not be a real estate investor. So I don't have a whole lot of specific goals with real estate, aside from the fact that it is a tool and I'll use it when it comes time. But considering I quit my W-2 to do this, real estate isn't like a huge drive for me right now, because you're going to spend a lot of time and money and energy to find that perfect little property to get $300 in cash flow a month. Woo. Like, that's just not, I'd rather start businesses and grow businesses and build relationships and use real estate. So for me, my long-term real estate goals are just, if I can utilize it to build community and build businesses, then that's what I want to do.
Can you share any insights or advice for individuals looking to transition from their current career, their W-2, into real estate or even business building, as you're saying, especially in the context of, your unique background? How did that transition go? Kind of delve into that.
Yeah. So I will say I'm a little unique in the sense that I am still a reservist. So I still do have a W-2 part-time. So there's that. And as far as my advice to others that are looking to transition from their W-2, I would look to find ways to use your W-2 rather than transition. And maybe transitioning is the move. Maybe you hate your job and it's toxic. And if that's the case, absolutely find ways out. But if you're just in a rut and maybe getting a little excited because you've got a new hobby and a new interest and you're diving deep into real estate, I would say pump the brakes a little bit and figure out how to use that experience and knowledge that you can gain. I mean, I'm a huge proponent of like everything must serve a purpose. Like, I continue to serve in the military. I moved from active duty to reserves because I felt like active duty was no longer serving me. It was holding me back. I was incapable of getting the additional education and training and experience that I wanted. And so I wanted to flourish and I felt like I had a ceiling that was just kind of cramping me. And so I continue to use the military as a reservist, as somebody who's still building my career on that side, who's still able to leverage all of my benefits of the military. I mean, I have very cheap medical benefits, my dental, my things that when you are working for yourself, now you have to think about these really tough personal expenses that It's a lot. And then once you become a business owner and a solopreneur, you realize now you have to figure out marketing. Now you have to figure out how to do payroll and just bookkeeping and all of these things that you used to have an entire HR department for that. And you just had to do nothing and get a W-2 annually. And so the amount of additional labor that goes into being a self-employed person and a small business is a lot. And I'm not saying don't do it. I'm doing it and I love it. But I do think if you can still find purpose and find a way to use your W-2 and the network that you have with that W-2, I wouldn't get so fixated on quitting and leaving your job and replacing your income as much as supplementing and growing and leveraging, because there's a lot of hype around just leaving your W-2s, and the grass isn't always greener. And if it is greener, no, there's a lot of fertilizer, which is shit. So anything green has a lot of shit, and it's a hard journey for sure. So if somebody's looking to leave their W-2, keep some very realistic targets in mind and also ask yourself, do I hate this? Is this toxic? And if the answers are no and no, you know, maybe just coast and learn and grow and do this stuff on the side, because you are super bankable too when you got a W-2. Typically, if you got this golden handcuff W-2 that's like at the 80K to 100K, and you're like, well, I could make so much more as a real estate investor. And it's like, yeah, but you could also do both. Now you can leverage creative, you can leverage traditional, you can leverage now the experience that you gain as an investor. So you know about DSCRs and you can get hard money loans and you can do all these things that you leave your W-2, all of a sudden you don't have that leverage anymore. So I just say, just like I say, use real estate, use your W-2, because everything's about leverage.
That's great advice. I do agree. There is often this grass is always greener, and you hear a lot of influencers saying there's, you know, you can go and quit your W-2. And I think it's not as easy as it's often promoted to be. And yes, absolutely. If you are satisfied and fulfilled in your W-2 and you're just looking to go and enhance that, because the reality is our incomes are often not quite enough these days to go and sustain. So yes, we need to be probably thinking about how to enhance what our income is and hedge against inflation and things like that. But that may or may not be quitting your W-2. And if your W-2 needs to go, then
yeah,
that's fine. There are ways to do
it. Thank you for your service, Marie Kondo it.
Yeah, right. Well, Melissa, how can our audience connect with you for your services? What would be the best way to go and connect with you? And I can go and put this also in the description for our YouTube video, but for those who listen on Spotify, what would be a great way to connect?
Sure. So I got @melpalmer.me is my Instagram. In there, I do have my website linked, but I will also say my website is cardinal-creative.com. And that is where you can check out my services, a lot of frequently asked questions. I've got a description of my background and the service offerings themselves. And then you can submit a form for consulting, the borrower's verification, or the due diligence for the lenders.
Well, in closing, I just want to extend my heartfelt gratitude to you, Melissa, for joining us on today's episode. Hopefully, Melissa's journey from military veteran to a dynamic real estate investor and business owner, developer, and due diligence expert is inspiring to you and encouraging to our other PMLs in our community who are trying to make sure that they're making safe transactions. Melissa's valuable insights into past experiences, current projects, and the crucial role of due diligence hopefully have shed a light on your ever-evolving journey into real estate investing. We hope you found today's episode helpful to you. Stay tuned for more engaging conversations on Nursing Real Wealth. Thank you for tuning in.